Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, where the editors of the magazine that always did hate big government assemble at the beginning of each work week to do primal therapy about the news. I am Matt Welch, joined by Nick Gillespie, Peter Sudeman, and Catherine Meng Yu. Ward, happy Pride Month, everyone.
Hey, Matt, it's not work if you love it to death.
Hi, howdy, everyone, for that little... You're going to get that painted on a sign and hang it in your kitchen next to the live, laugh, love?
I'm going to get it tattooed on my front. It's already on my back.
Happy Tuesday.
So speaking of big government, I was about ready to go on a tangent about the Revolutionary War in Brooklyn, but I'm not going to do that. So I just want to point that out. So speaking of
you
big government...
You want credit for that?
We've got a lot of big government, Peter. So we already swole up a $1.9 trillion American rescue plan earlier in the Biden presidency. And on Friday, I believe, of last week, the president came up with his budget proposal, which is just a huge ratchet, kind of a permanent $6 trillion that goes up to $8 trillion maybe by the end of the decade. And then there's also the Eternal Infrastructure Week negotiations. Here. So, Peter, presidential budget proposals are works of speculative fiction, as we have pointed out before, although White Houses do have an inordinate amount of leverage in legislative proposals like the infrastructure package and such like. So give us a kind of what the hell, what's the state of play down the street from your house in Washington, D.C. with the spending of all of my grandchildren's money?
The era of big government is back, baby. Just like movie theaters. No, you're right. Like, this thing should totally win the Hugo for, like, best space opera because it is just a sprawling, gigantic product.
It can't, Peter, because like, it was written by a white man.
I stand corrected. But it's like a vision for the future, right? That's what a presidential budget is a roadmap for the future. And this one is, you could say, more ambitious, which is to say more spendy than most of them that we have seen before, right? The short version here is lots of spending, lots of debt, and lots of taxes. So the annual federal spending would rise to about $6 trillion this year. And like you said, then over a decade would end up over $8 trillion if we followed Biden's budget plan. We'd have deficits of about $1.3 trillion or more every single year for at least the next decade. And who knows after that. If our Hugo is going to a work of fantasy rather than futuristic sci-fi, and there's like a federal tentacle monster at the heart of it, it would be much bigger and have many more tentacles than we are used to, right? So for the last 40 years or so, government has represented about one-fifth. The federal government, I should say, has represented about one-fifth of the total U.S. economy. This would bring it closer to a quarter. I just want to read two choice quotes from the New York Times. This is from their news report on Joe Biden's budget proposal. The spending in the budget amounts to a permanent increase in the size of the federal footprint on the U.S. economy. And also, that spending represents an attempt to expand the size and scope of federal engagement in Americans' daily lives. So this is not just sort of like, let's have a slightly bigger military and let's have, you know, spend a little bit more on Medicare because people are getting older, although that is in there too. This is about expanding federal government programs and building a whole bunch of new ones and also hiring a whole bunch of new federal government workers. The American Federation of Government Employees actually thanked the president on Friday for proposing, quote, substantial staffing increases to multiple agencies. So this is in one way to think about this is just as a jobs program for federal employees.
Can we break that union? Can we just get the Pinkertons on those guys?
And the other thing I want to just sort of flag for folks here is that there is a lot of what you might call hidden spending on healthcare in particular. And this is a really interesting and notable aspect of the budget that I think is going to get less play than it should, because Biden's budget expresses support. Like, he's in favor of a bunch of expansions to Obamacare and to Medicare, letting people buy in earlier, adding a public option, which is which is a federally run health insurance plan that would compete on the exchanges, compete in air quotes. And he did these things, and they're expensive. I mean, it would cost a lot of money to expand Medicare and to add a whole new government-run insurance option, but he didn't include any cost estimates at all. And so this is Biden's way of saying, hey, look, we want to do these programs, but we're not even going to tell you how much they cost. And so all of these big, in some cases, record-setting numbers, in a lot of ways, they're probably too low for what this budget actually represents, because Biden's actual vision for federal fiscal policy is even more expansive than those headline estimates represent.
Catherine, picking up on what Peter mentioned about, you know, more federal government sort of intrusion into Americans' lives. A decade or so ago, we did a classic cover issue with Your Terrible Hands called How to Slash Government Before It Slashes You. That was kind of, you know, there was a tinge of hopefulness back then because there was an audience for people who were interested in hearing about cutting government or at least restraining its growth. There's not much of an audience among elected officials on the national level for that anymore. So let's talk about government slashing you, or to get ourselves mentally prepared of what comes next. What are ways in which this government in particular, perhaps, or government as a general thing, can get up into your business in a bad way when it expands up to $6 trillion and then into $8 trillion and so on? And if you would like, you can punch Joe Biden in the face about the gig economy as well in your answer.
I would love.
But only metaphorically and verbally, because actual punching would violate the non-aggression clause.
I'm not going to do any actual punching. And that's also just a note for the Secret Service. I will not be punching anyone in the face, though metaphorically, I am always up for that. If I do punch Joe Biden in the face, I would like you to pay me a piece rate. Like, I only want you to pay me on contract to punch Joe Biden in the face. Pay me as an employee to punch Joe Biden in the face, even though, of course, paying people on contract and not as employees is the greatest scourge facing America today. And thank God we have not only federal legislation, but also multiple state legislatures working on this, especially and including California, which has screwed it up so badly that I can't even begin to convey to you. We do not, in fact, need people to be treated as full-time employees for them to have, for instance, basic low-level worker protections or, I don't know, benefits. Like, those things don't have to be the same thing, except for that we already have a bunch of bad federal laws and regulations that create the conditions for that. Yes, as you mentioned, there is a good little podcast Easter egg. The cover from Slash Government Before It Slashes You is, in fact, me, my only appearance as a hand model, because I was deemed to have the creepiest hands in the Reason office. And that is just the God's truth. I'm charmed by our past selves. Don't you think it's so nice that our past selves thought that we might cut government, like, for realies? Like, That was a moment we were having when the Tea Party didn't seem to just be about being cuckoo bananas and instead seemed to be maybe actually about the size of government. That moment is over. The Sunday shows this weekend, Pete Buttigieg said, while Republicans philosophically seem to agree that trillion-dollar investments are the kind of thing we need to be doing right now, there's still a lot of daylight between the two sides. Pete, I wish there was daylight between the two sides, but there really isn't very much unless you count the $0.7 trillion worth of daylight between the two plans right now.
No, you should. This is actually worth. I actually want to make a small point here about the difference between the Republican proposal and the Democratic proposal. So the Republican
infrastructure
on infrastructure, which is what Buttigieg
right.
is.
Which is, to be clear, just a small
about,
slice
right?
again.
Which,
of
which
the
is only one part.
By the way, I'm glad that the puberty blockers seem to be working Secretary
Nick?
Buttigieg.
Nicholas,
I am not,
we already
I'm just not
going to
engage with this. I'm going to talk about the actual spending plan. And so the Republican plan is nearly $1 trillion. And the Biden administration was like, OK, so you've come up from your 500 and something billion dollar plan. And $1 trillion is better in some ways. But here's the big problem with that $1 trillion. Not enough of it is, quote, new spending. It might have been the quote might have been new funds. Right. What the Republicans did was they found a way to pay for about three quarters of their $1 trillion by pulling money from other sources, mostly previous pandemic relief bills, because we passed trillions and trillions of dollars worth of pandemic relief spending last year and then already again this year.
And didn't spend
Republicans,
the money.
And we didn't spend all of the money. And so what Republicans were saying was, okay, these are These are policy priorities. Let's find money that has already been passed to use to push these policy priorities through. And what it turns out is that the Biden administration doesn't just care about the policy priorities. They care about the spending for its own sake, right? Independent of the policy priority. And that is really notable that they're saying this isn't good enough because it doesn't have enough new additional spending on top of the absolutely crazy amounts of spending that we've already done.
I'm going to insert myself before Nick talks, which is to say that just mirrors what...
I love it, by the way. You could see we are on Skype with each other and you could see that Nick was not about to talk, but Matt was not taking any chances.
I never want to look at you people when I'm talking. So this is an audio podcast, man.
Yeah, the feeling's mutual.
I mean, if the people out there could see not just my bad hair, but my bad shirt, then it would all make a lot of sense. No, just that what Peter just talked about in the infrastructure bill was also in place during the Trump administration, right? Everyone laughs at the infrastructure week that was always coming up. The Trump administration started off with a $500 billion infrastructure bill, doubled it at some point to a $1 trillion proposal. And there was a lot of vagueness in it, but there was also some specifics, including allowing for private equity to come in and invest in the building of roads and things like that to a degree that is not currently allowed, as the sainted Bob Poole, who I'm just going to talk about every week, has pointed out for a long time.
He's alive.
You can be a living saint, Nick, right? Fact check.
Blessed be Bob
Poole. Technically, no.
Sure, yeah.
Really?
I think you have to be.
Not in the Christian tradition or the Catholic tradition, but in Buddhist.
Okay.
Sure.
The Democratic response at that time, which was probably led by Chuck Schumer, who's like showing up at every, street festival in New York these days, cadging all the food and singing karaoke. Look it up. At any rate, Democrats didn't have any details in their objection to that at the time, except for we don't like this because it isn't all government spending the money. We don't want the private people spending money. We want it all to be government. And everything else was like there's a complete lack of details. So this is consistent with where Democrats have gone and have been going for a while. Nick Gillespie cut me off for crying out loud. I would remind all of us, and maybe just tee up Nick this way, and I use the word ratchet also to attract your Spock ears there, Nick, that if we had kept government spending at basically every single level of government, federal, state, local, micro, then at the same rates as 2000, and just increased by inflation and population size, everyone would have a surplus. Oprah would be giving out surpluses to absolutely everybody forever until kingdom come.
Well, Oprah has more important things to be doing. I mean, she's counseling the, third prince of England off the ledge. So, she can't be giving out cars anymore.
That is true.
Even electric cars.
Talk about the ratchet, Nick, and how come we haven't, the last time we slashed government was at the end of World War II, as we write about in that issue, because we had to. We had to sort of like slow down and decommission. There were a ton of scare stories about how it would be horrible, and it actually wasn't. But every single thing has ratcheted since. Why is that? How is that?
This is Robert Higgs in his book, The Economic Historian in Crisis and Leviathan, kind of introduced or solidified the idea of the ratchet effect, which is that during times of crisis, oftentimes economic crisis, sometimes military crisis or civil, kind of social crises, government tends to expand, and then it does go back to a lower level than whatever peak it reached, but usually at a higher level than what it started out as. And certainly, something like the Depression and World War II exemplify that, where after World War II, after victory was ours in 1945, over the next several years, government spending went down significantly from its peak during World War II, but not to what it had been prior to World War II or to the Depression. And that kind of basic dynamic has stayed in place ever since, except that the ratchet has been, it's been more of a ramp up where, generally speaking, it was pretty consistently going up. at various points, there was a big spike during LBJ and the Great Society, the twin projects of the Great Society, social welfare spending, as well as Vietnam spending and defense spending. It did come down a little bit, in at various points. It came down most explicitly in the United States after the end of the Cold War. There was a peace dividend that both H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton talked about, and we reduced spending in inflation-adjusted terms per capita. There was also a moment, and Matt, you wrote pretty eloquently about this, about the way George W. Bush during the financial crisis talked about having to destroy, capitalism in order to save it. There was a spasm at the end of George W. Bush's time in office, which he led a massive increase in spending all the way around, that Obama then ran with a bit and got his big stimulus package passed within a couple months of taking office. There was a brief slowdown after that. So the kind of ratchet things go up and then they kind of lock into place higher than where they started, but not quite at the peak. What is different this time, and I'd be curious as to what Catherine and Peter think about this as kind of students of the growth of spending of government, there does not even seem to be the pretense that we are ever going to spend less than we spent the year before. There are a lot of reasons for that. And, is the fact that the Republican Party had a rhetoric of fiscal discipline that they constantly just were hypocritical about, certainly under Ronald Reagan, but especially under W. Bush and under Donald Trump. But we don't even have the pretense now of the idea that we can spend less than we spent the year before. And this is troubling because there is no clear reason why we should be spending more year after year for government stuff. It just doesn't make sense, but there's where we are.
Peter, maybe as a way of looking at that, be the boy who cried wolf about the due dates, the bills coming due on government spending when it comes to entitlements, which used to be old age entitlements in particular, which used to be something that presidents of both parties pretended at least to care about and occasionally made some actions in the direction of acting on that professed care.
Although, yeah. Can I add, one of the problems with the old age entitlements, and I'm thinking of Reagan in particular, Reagan towards the end of his second term pushed a bunch of tax increases that were mostly payroll tax increases that he said when he was leaving office, he said this was the greatest thing that he had accomplished, which was securing the funding for Social Security and Medicare for another generation, which was more or less true by hiking FICA taxes. So, one of the problems is if you don't reform old age entitlements, but merely come up with ways to pay them, all you're doing is increasing government spending. And that we have even lost the thread of paying for old age entitlements. But even more fundamentally, we need to be getting rid of them and coming up with a new way to help people who need help. That's not a universal plan that just bankrupts everyone.
What's coming right down the pike, Peter, looking in the future of CBO reports and whatnot when it comes to these things?
I think Nick is right that Biden's budget represents a push to make emergency spending levels the sort that we've seen during the pandemic, to make them permanent, to make emergency spending the new normal. Because as I said, as the infrastructure package negotiations really make clear, new spending is the objective for the Biden administration. And some of that is just going to kind of be built into the budget naturally because of entitlements, which are on autopilot, which we pay no matter what until we can't pay them anymore. And so the budget projects that with baby boomers entering entering retirement, Medicare spending is going to double in the next decade, and Social Security spending is going to rise by 75%. Those are big increases to, I believe, the two biggest federal programs. And that's just a giant expense. And so we talked about pronatalist policy on this podcast a couple of weeks ago. And one of the big reasons that people are talking about the birth dearth and birth rates is because those programs are just, and we just have to say this over and over and over again, Those programs are not savings programs. You pay into them when you're a worker, and that money goes directly to current retirees. And so that money isn't yours. It's not being locked away or socked away. There's no lockbox. There's no trust fund. The trust fund itself is an accounting illusion. The only way that those programs work is if a bunch of young workers can pay for current retirees' benefits. And there are going to be a lot more current retirees over the next decade. And so costs are just absolutely going to balloon. And the way that the budget is set up is that all of that spending is on autopilot. It just gets spent no matter what, up until the point where you can't do it anymore. And at least with Medicare, that's coming pretty quickly. One of the biggest trust funds, so there's a bunch of different funds within Medicare, but one of the biggest trust funds in Medicare is currently projected to be insolvent. That's not bankrupt. It's a little different. It just means you can't pay all of your bills. But by 2026, so real soon, and then Social Security is consistently projected to be insolvent sometime in the 2030s. The date changes a little bit every year. These are not dates that are very far off, and yet neither party is really thinking about what to do about this. And, you know, President Trump, when he ran, ran pretty explicitly against touching Medicare or Social Security benefits. Medicaid was a little bit of a different story, but Medicare and Social Security are in some ways the bigger issues. And Trump's position was, hell no, we're not going to touch those things. Those benefits are sacrosanct. Well, they're not going to be when we can't pay them anymore.
Catherine, it is your job, as you well know, as editor of the Reason editorial franchise, to be an optimist, or at least be a truffle pig for optimism, rooting around the manure of the forest for a truffle of optimism. About
just pull just some of those trees, truffles up,
not manure.
Put it in some olive oil, put it on your popcorn. Delicious.
Popcorn, bad. Anyways, Catherine, is there anything out there in the world, in the politics, in the policy, in the discussion, in the ether that allows for any optimism about reactions to or against this type of kind of ever bloating thing of government out there?
Whew.
Mm. Truffle pig it.
This truffle pig is so tired. She's just, she needs a nap. No, Matt, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. I can't.
That's fine.
It doesn't look good out there. As always, I do not look to the business of politics for my optimism. But if I did, I would be sad right now. I mean, Pete Buttigieg is right. He went on the Sunday shows and said, it's cool Republicans agree the government should be much larger and spend at least another $1 trillion today, but we want more. That's where we are. That's our politics right now. And the people that we have talked about on this podcast over the years, who we generally think are good and doing good work, have left the Republican Party. They all took their balls and went home. Matt has done a good job of writing a bunch of columns for the magazine over the last couple of years about how there were people with little glimmers of good who bailed out, who left, who Trump drove away, or who just our general political gestalt drove away. I don't think it was just Trump. I think there was already just a pre-existing bipartisan consensus emerging that everything we do should be bigger and more. And there are people who don't want to be a part of that, and they left. And I think, you know, we see, like, we've talked on this podcast about Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona, who is the only person that I have my eye on as even remotely doing anything good. And she just seems to be, in some ways, in the Tea Party mold. She's sort of a troll for the good side. And I'm not mad about that. I love me some trolls for the good side. Some of my best friends are trolls for the good side, the side of limited government and kind of constrained government. But I don't think she's exactly going to be libertarian Jesus, and to look to her for that would be wrong. So, you know, as always, Matt, I'm going to give you my fallback speech, since it's a Tuesday after Memorial Day and everybody else already gave their fallback speech, which is like, you know, what gives me optimism is everything that's not the government. Like, we beat COVID, yo. Like, we did that.
Cancel
culture is healing.
Is doing great.
And so there's some good stuff out there.
I'd
but
say
boy,
we
howdy,
are beating COVID. I don't know if I would say it
has been beaten.
I don't know. Or is COVID beating us?
And it's good. And but wow, everything the government is doing is bad.
Hey, can I throw this at Matt Welch, a guy who
I don't know, give us some optimism.
A decade ago or more. Yeah, Matt Welch. You were talking and you collaborated with somebody. I don't remember who. It probably doesn't matter. But talking about how, you know, it is always darkest before the dawn, and that in the teeth of, you know, Richard Milhouse Nixon establishing wage and price controls, taking us off the gold standard, quadrupling down in Vietnam, you know, et cetera, ad nauseum, creating the BATF, you name
10%
it.
10% tariff, don't forget.
Something arose. You know, actually congratulating the Redskins, you know, and talking to Neil Armstrong on the moon. You know,
calling
he was very
sweeps
busy.
From the sideline.
Yeah, but that's something, you know, very unprecedented and unexpected happened that changed things. So you tell me. Why aren't, you know, what's going to happen that is going to give rise to a libertarian moment in the next 15 minutes?
That I am not going to predict. No, I just predict pain. At some point, there will be pain directly felt from this, and people will respond to that pain out of necessity. I don't think it's going to get brighter anytime soon, but we're going to be running out of options on some levels of policy that you're not going to be able to spend your way out of it, whether it's inflation coming back, whether it's we're imposing another lumber tariff and nobody could build a house for under $1 million.
Yeah, can someone like briefly give me a why is wood so expensive explainer? I keep seeing this and I don't do building of
demand
things.
Demand and tariffs.
Is it just always assume it's the government's fault, but I don't know.
Biden is wants to extend or increase the tariff against Canada. That's Trump era, and it's probably like a national security BS tariff.
I feel like I need to assign a
Scott Lincecum. Just control.
You can't build your kids a playhouse this summer because of the tariffs.
There was a great recent Onion headline where Biden pledges to continue policy that Trump, Obama, Bush, Clinton, Bush, Reagan defended. You know, one of the things, and this may be a baby step to getting to a point where there is a political reckoning and a kind of awakening, is the through line of the past 20, 25, 30 years of American politics. You know, we are trained, and this is the point of political campaigns and whatnot, to make very sharp distinctions when, in fact, there's a lot of commonality. And certainly the first few months, and it feels like years, of Biden's presidency, it's like, what exactly is he doing that is radically different than Donald Trump? I think even his ardent supporters would have to, you know, be kind of like, well, you know, I mean, they're stumbling.
I mean, they have an answer for that. And it's that he has pushed through a tremendous, like definitely much more spending than would have existed if Trump had been elected for a second term.
You know what? There was a lot of spending that happened last year.
But
and
that,
Donald Trump increased in his first 3 years, increased spending by like $1,400.
I agree. But here's
America,
the thing. I think this is what Peter was saying about Democrats are now measuring their success by the number. Right. And so it's not what they're doing, because he's not actually doing very many new things. It's just how much money is he doing it with? And yes, for sure, Trump spent trillions in exactly the same mold. But that number would have been lower under a Republican right now. And it's just because the Democrats are maximizing for number of dollars. They're not maximizing for policy impact or for even for new programs right now. I do think Biden will probably switch to maximizing for new permanent programs, right? Like he is going to at some point switch over to like, okay, we got to do whatever we're going to do on the environment. We got to do whatever we're going to do on entitlements, which in his case will be to make them bigger and shore them up and make them more intrusive.
I don't disagree with that. And to Peter's point, you know, there's a question of what gets posted as the spending versus what actually goes out the door. There's a differential there. But it's also worth thinking about that whatever stupid child, you know, credit, tax credit that Biden has actually gotten through, there's at least two major Republicans, Josh Hawley and Mitt Romney, who are like, you know what, that's not enough. Yeah. We need to, you know, triple it or something. So that, again, that continuity, you know, it's not to say they're exactly the same, but it's like, man, you know, Biden isn't doing a lot on immigration. He's not doing a lot on tariffs. He's not doing a lot that's different.
So I think there's a through line, but there is there are some distinctions and differences as well. And one of the biggest is taxes, which is one thing that Republicans actually care about. And this goes back to Matt's point about at some point there will be pain. And one of the things that is interesting about Biden's budget and about his approach to fiscal policy is that he keeps trying to insulate ordinary people, even somewhat extraordinary people, right? Most Americans,
$400,000 a year.
Most Americans from having to feel tax pain as a result of all of this spending. And so, you know, he has said that there's not going to be any tax increases on families that earn up to $400,000 a year. And yet his budget proposal does allow for the individual tax breaks in the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act that Republicans passed in 2017. So that was the Republican tax cut bill that the one big piece of economic policy they did back in 2017. It included a bunch of tax breaks for individuals, but those were sunsetted because of reconciliation. And so they are set to expire in the middle of this decade. Biden's plan would let those tax breaks expire, which would mean that middle-class families would see higher taxes. But he's also saying, at the same time, actually, we want to work with Congress to make sure that those taxes don't go up for earners under $400,000 a year. So there is this weird sort of like two-headed, I mean, like he's disagreeing with himself in a lot of ways. His budget says that the taxes will go up for people making less than $400,000. And then he's saying, no, actually, we won't. But the budget gets to take credit for all of that revenue, which means that the deficit, the annual deficits are going to be lower. Now, they're still quite high. So it's really a mess. And it is politically incoherent. Politically, it makes sense, but it is incoherent in a lot of ways. And it is this kind of odd thing where there's all of this spending and all of these costs that are being incurred, and Biden's message is, but look, almost no one is actually going to end up feeling any sort of personal pain because of this. Like, you are safe. It's just going to be a small number of rich people and giant corporations, right? And what that reveals in a lot of ways is that Americans don't really want to pay for the government that we have and that Joe Biden is proposing. And where you see all these Nordic countries, right, the Scandinavian model, all of that, like all of those countries that have much bigger governments as a share of their GDP, they all have much higher tax burdens on the middle class. And even Joe Biden, big spending, big government Joe Biden, is at least saying that that is not something that he's willing to do in order to pay for a government that's actually a federal government, at least, that is not as big as those Scandinavian countries.
Can I throw out a possible libertarian heresy that might just turn this whole big ball of wax around, Matt? Uh-huh. Welch?
If you turn a ball of wax around, it's still a ball of wax.
Yeah, I know, but it's heading in a different direction, you know? It's picking up a different kind of
steam.
You know, floor scum. Now, what we should be doing as libertarians is pushing for full financing of government in a given year. You know, William Niskanen, who is now unfortunately remembered mostly as a namesake for one of the worst think tanks in America, right? Or least friendly, least befriended think tanks in America. And Peter Van Doren of Cato, years ago, they did a thing where when taxes go up and people are forced to actually pay for the government that they want, surprisingly, ceteris paribus, when the price goes up for something, they want less of it. And we are riding on, you know, a idea where we're paying like, you know, 40 cents a dollar for government spending because it's all borrowed. And we're like, oh, yeah, we're not going to get freaked out by it. If we had to, you know, if we had to be taxed in order to cover $6 or $8 trillion of spending in a given year, there would be a revolt and people would be like, you know what? I think we can get by with a bare bones
all right.
government.
We're going to get to our email of the week here in a moment. But first, are you experiencing depression, stress, anxiety, insomnia? or other mental and emotional maladies, you can do something about that today. Visit betterhelp.com/roundtable and get instant confidential access to a network of licensed mental health professionals in all 50 states. BetterHelp.com, that's H-E-L-P, like what Mike Flynn is going to need for his wacky presidential succession schemes to work, has helped more than 1 million people take charge of their own mental health. Listeners to the Roundtable get a special deal, 10% off your first month. BetterHelp.com is more affordable than traditional online counseling services. Financial aid is available. Go to the website, BetterHelp.com/Roundtable. Describe your issues and favored delivery methods. You'll be set up with someone to talk to within 24 hours. It's BetterHelp.com. Do it today. You'll be glad you did. Okay, send your email questions of the week to roundtable@reason.com. Today's comes from Levi Rodriguez, but it's Levi. I want Levi Rodriguez because that's a really good name. So that's how I'm pronouncing it, regardless of whether that's Levi Rodriguez. He writes, I think there is a strong case to be made to prohibit cruises from requiring vaccine confirmation. As soon as you grant the premise that the CDC can boss you around unilaterally, we will never go back. I see no problem with Florida and other states mandating that businesses grow a spine and tell the CDC, cover your ears, to fuck off. We cannot be governed by the CDC and other medical tyrants at any cost. Disgust. Catherine?
I am always happy to tell the CDC to fuck off. I sometimes just like repeat it while meditating in the evenings just to wind down
like Don Draper.
For the day, like Don Draper. But I don't think that's the same question as whether or not cruise ships can require vaccinations before you board. I have never been on a cruise ship, probably will never get on a cruise ship. Never say never. I look forward.
Wait a second. Did you not go on any of the recent cruises?
I was inconveniently pregnant.
That's why they failed.
Wow. Yeah.
I mean, all pregnancy is inconvenient. Sorry, Josh Hawley, but
yeah. I was pregnant, but they made me go anyway.
Yeah.
They made me have an abortion.
That's how libertarians are.
The cruise I was on was pregnant.
It was
with
like
meaning.
Marilyn Manson was running the Reason Foundation.
So I'm sorry. I'm sorry, sir. Your question deserves serious treatment and not the horrible specter of pregnant Nick Gillespie on a boat. But here we are. I think this is something that we've talked about before, but I feel very strongly that there is a huge and important distinction between private businesses saying, hey, we'd love to have your business, but we have this condition. The condition is we'd like you to be vaccinated before we do business with you. That is a voluntary transaction between two people or entities. That is a thing that I would like to maximize, as many voluntary transactions as possible between people and companies and the people that started the companies. That is the world that I dream of. The CDC being involved in that decision sucks, just like the CDC being involved in, I don't know, the real estate market sucks, just like the CDC being involved in whether or not my kids have to wear a mask outdoors at summer camp this summer sucks, although I think they recently said that's okay now or something. Who knows? But those are two different things. And I think state governors and the CDC at war with each other, like there are no heroes in that story, because they are both, in the end, using the threat of force from the state to pick the side that wins. So Ron DeSantis versus the CDC, I don't know. I don't have a side, but CDC.
I'm going to vote for whichever side. We'll put Matt Welch in
CDC
cage.
Versus.
That's what I'm just going to say.
Versus private decision makers. I'll choose the private decision makers every time, even if they want me to show my vaccine card.
But Nick Gillespie, is that sufficient in a world?
Yes. I know you're asking Nick, but it really is sufficient. People keep asking that question, and it really, really is. Sorry, go ahead.
Is it sufficient in a world where the CDC can make heavy breathed suggestions that are then followed by private industry to do things like require, you know, me to show a vaccine card to go to a basketball game?
So private businesses are doing that. The CDC is not insisting.
No, but CDC guidance is then picked up by your cruise lines and used as their reason for establishing essentially a vaccine passport in this case, which you are on record as being hostile towards. Mm-hmm. Is it not an
act against all passports, Matt Welch?
Is it not an act of federalism? Simple as that, for a governor to say, look, you know, I don't want you to be influencing private business in this way, and therefore I don't want to create the possibility.
So I'm going to ban everybody that I have jurisdiction over from making up their own mind. I'm with Catherine on this one. It's got to be, you know, this gets me into trouble with various kinds of federalists and localists and subsidiarists or whatever, but like, I think you should be libertarian all the way down, and that there should just be, at every level of government, there should be less coercion and less one size fits all in any kind of political arena. It should be, you know, voluntary associations are different, whether they're businesses or religious communities or, I don't know, other types of intentional communities. But I don't want Ron DeSantis setting policy for me any more than I want Anthony Fauci or Donald Trump or Joe Biden or, you know, Kamala Harris.
And yet David French does nothing. Peter, will you not stick up for the there's many libertarians out there in the world who on their, you know, on their pinned tweet, you know, we'll say this is the big one. We got to do everything to mobilize against anything having to do with vaccine passports and any kind of government intersection with encouraging that type of behavior. Will you not stick up for the line in the sand?
So I'm not going to stick up for DeSantis's mandate, but I will stick up for the questioner who I think in some ways had the right idea of just saying that private businesses need to grow a pair. Because what is happening here is that private businesses want the approval.
Hey, he was gender neutral.
Sorry?
He said grow a spine.
Oh, all right.
He
grow
said
a spine,
grow a
then.
Spine.
There could be a pair of
genitals. Technically, grow a pair
this.
Is gender neutral.
Thank you.
Yes, there we go.
I too have
right.
two gonads,
so,
my friend.
The solution here is
yeah, that's but we're not talking
here
about gonads
is not for DeSantis to mandate the way that this gets handled, nor is it for the CDC to be sort of determining all of this. The solution is for private cruise ships to say, here is what we think is the best policy. This is why we think so. And then to advertise that to customers. And if they think the best policy is to say that, look, we want to make you feel safe by making by guaranteeing to the extent we can that everybody here is vaccinated, then they should do that. And if they want to say, hey, look, this is the unvaccinated cruise. Please come on our unvaccinated cruise ship. They should be able to do that, too. And, you know, sort of the core issue here to me is you don't want to fight bad guidance and bad mandates with other bad mandates. What you want is to make the original bad policy or bad guidance something that is not effective. And look, I think I wouldn't go on a I would not go on a cruise ship probably at all, but definitely not unless people were vaccinated. But I understand that some people, you know, would want to do something else. And what people should have are options that they negotiate amongst themselves with private vendors, not a bunch of competing mandates in which different levels of authority are fighting to determine which solution and which business model wins out.
I mean, an unvaccinated cruise ship is basically a smoking flight, right? Which neither of which I would be on, but both of which I think should be legal, and for which there is some substantial demand, I expect.
I think that, you know, the first cruise line that comes up with a vaccine for chlamydia is probably going to do better than anything related to COVID, Matt Welch.
I want to no smoking, but everyone has to eat edibles flight.
Oh my God,
no. Can you imagine? I was just this
it
morning,
would be
I
so
fell
chill.
Down a Twitter. I fell down a Twitter rabbit hole of looking at the head of the flight attendant union's Twitter, and she does seem to be a villain. Just quick look suggests that she's really.
Are you sure
aggressive.
It wasn't an ad for Cruella on Disney Plus?
She retweeted somebody just saying, "If you were nice to your flight attendants, we'd give you back the alcohol," which was a real like, "Whoa!" So I'm going to turn this plane right around.
Wow.
But I would join the flight attendants union if it was an all edibles flight, because they would need worker protections.
Yeah, everyone's so chill, Suderman.
Nope. You know what happened when the Reason office did edibles that time?
I really enjoyed it. I was very chill, as you know.
I just don't know. Let's go. Well, I guess quickly. The whole notion. Yeah,
where?
What? Sorry.
About Matt, I was going to say, like, you keep slipping the noose. You just slip the hangman. Where are you on all of these mandates?
You keep being the host of this podcast. How dare you?
It's weird. Yeah. Like asking questions and everything. I don't like mandates. That's it. I'm basically with Catherine. I would like to see less of it. And I also don't. There's something I have the sense, and this is not numerated in any way or measured in any way, but that, you know, jumping the banks from vaccine passports and COVID altogether, that we're seeing a lot of state level activity from governors in places who are governing against the federal governments, not even just in terms of the relationship between the federal government and the state government, which is a very legitimate thing to kind of work out and work against. But just like, I don't like what Democrats are doing on a national level, so I'm going to crack down on big tech in Florida. Like the nationalization of our politics, and where all the energy is sort of directed at our national debates, has made it so that red state or blue state people end up taking these largely symbolic, often unconstitutional kind of petulant acts of policy on the state and local level that are directed at the national government, federal government. And I'm just kind of disquieted by that as an entire process. And this feels the specific thing under discussion with DeSantis. It actually has more like tangible relevance of, you know, Cruz business in Florida is a very big and important thing. But still, there's something wrapped up in that. It feels like a trend line that's going in a bad direction.
What if we sweeten it with a ban on critical race?
See,
theory,
that's
Matt,
that's what I'm talking
but
about.
But also free season tickets to the Florida Marlins.
That's a punishment. For crying out loud, going there.
Or WNBA tickets. Mandatory attendance, but everything else is free
at the New York Liberty. Yeah, so I'm disquieted by all that, and I also have the impression that in a pretty short order of time, even as COVID ravages in places like India and Brazil and elsewhere in really alarming ways, with under vaccinated populations plus new variants that transmit more easily. Yet even with that backdrop, a lot of the arguments that we've been having that are very passionate about COVID, you know, vaccine passports and masking policies and even the grumble asterisks CDC policies about masking in summer camps, that a lot of that's just going to disappear, just like the masks off people's faces when you walk down the streets of New York. Eventually, they're going to melt.
Well, concerning that vaccination has become so polarized along partisan lines, with heavy Trump supporters being some of the most vaccine hesitant here. And that is a big part of the DeSantis policy and the fight here, is that this is a kind of it is DeSantis's way of getting on the good side of Trump supporters who think that you shouldn't get vaccinated. And the vaccines, look, I'm not for vaccine mandates, to be clear, but I think that that people should get themselves vaccinated. That is a good personal decision that you can make. And the vaccines are the thing that has worked. The more we look at studies of policies that were designed, of what would they call NPIs, non-pharmaceutical interventions, right? All of the mask mandates, all of the, like, you can't go more than 6 feet from your house when you're walking your dog, all of that stuff that was put in place at the state level last year, very little of it had a measurable effect. But what has clearly had a fast-acting, very positive effect on both cases and death rates are vaccines. And so, like, the vaccines work. They're saving people's lives. And this idea that, like, vaccines are somehow bad or dangerous, I think is actually a worrying one that that has become part of our political discourse, and that DeSantis's proposal here is playing into to some extent.
There's an interesting development in a couple of states. I can't name them off the top of my head, but let's just imagine there are Ohio and Idaho, because that sounds about right, where legislatures, Republican-run legislatures, are passing anti vaccine mandates for schools, and not just COVID. Like they're worried about, injecting all 12-year-olds as a condition to get back into school. And they're like, screw it, let's just stop vaccine mandates. And the thing is, there's a lot of, most every public school kid in this country has been vaccinated for hepatitis, which is weird on its face, at least to the layman who doesn't understand how these things spread. Most of that happens without comment. And yet now, because of the kind of fervency and the fraughtness of the national debate, you're seeing maybe some of those things will be rolled back too. It's very, very strange. Nick, I heard you saying.
Pew Research in 2015 found that 10% of conservatives, of self-identified conservatives, thought child vaccines were unsafe. 12% of self-described liberals. So this stuff is very situational.
And it's the COVID aspect of it too. Is, I mean, before where
we all, need a Trump vaccine.
So this is actually a thing that is worth just saying. We have a Trump vaccine. A friend of mine who is connected, who's sort of politically aware. Yes, it's called made the argument a couple of weeks ago that the single best decision made by any political leader anywhere in the world during the pandemic was Trump's decision to advance purchase vaccines, regardless of whether they were going to work or not. And this was a relatively small amount of money in the context of the incredible, incredible dump trucks full of $1 trillion coins that we have spent over the last year, right? It was a couple of $1 billion. It was the government equivalent of not even pocket change, right? And it worked. It worked really well because it meant that, yes, the vaccine rollout could have been faster. And yes, there are problems. And yes, many of the CDC and the FDA did not do a great job in a bunch of instances last year. And we probably could have had the vaccine sooner. But the United States has been rolling ahead of most Western democracies in terms of vaccine rollout. And as a result, we are getting out of COVID and getting past COVID much, much faster. And that is at least some credit to Trump for making the one good policy decision that I'm just going to say it is and was good, was we funded the vaccines. We did it with a small amount of money. Honestly, we probably should have spent much, 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 much less on almost everything else and maybe quite a bit more on vaccines.
Let's go to our end of podcast, what you have been consuming in the cultural sphere. Nick Gillespie, why don't you go first?
Hey, I've been watching Fox's Fox Broadcast Network show Let's Be Real, which is created in part by Robert Smigel, the guy behind Triumph, the comic insult dog or insult comic dog. It's a mix of puppets and live action. It is political, but also broadly satiric. In the very first episode opens with a press conference being given by a puppet version of Andrew Cuomo, where he is laying out New York's new social distancing guidelines for women around Andrew Cuomo. It's very funny and he's even like, you have to stay 6 feet, even if you're behind me, don't think that you're safe because I can get there. It had a great bit about Nancy Pelosi passing a handgun legislation where handguns and 9mm handguns included birth control. It had a great ongoing riff on the show Naked and Afraid with Ted Cruz. It's a very funny show. It is on Fox, I believe, on Thursday nights, and then it also airs on Hulu, if you get that. I hope that it is broad and wide-ranging. It takes no prisoners, and I hope for that reason it has success, because it actually makes fun of everything and everybody, not tit for tat, but just they go where the humor is. Let's be real.
Catherine, what have you been consuming?
I continue my advocacy of our listeners joining me in the fandom associated with the Green Brothers. This is John Green and Hank Green, who are internet people who also write books. And I have recommended on this podcast in the past John Green's podcast, The Anthropocene Reviewed. There is a book of it now, and I got that book, and I'm working my way through it. And there's some new stuff, and there's some stuff from the podcast. And the concept is that he just chooses stuff about being a person and talks about it a little bit and then reviews the thing on a 5-star scale. So he reviews viral meningitis and prom and Canada geese and like being the fan of a particular sports ball team that I can't remember the name of. And it is good, guys. It is like squishy and nice without being sanctimonious. And there is a dearth of that in our world. And so I recommend it. But if you want even less niceness and squishiness and sanctimony, you should also follow his brother, Hank Green, who does super funny science explainers on TikTok. So you may choose your Green brother. But John Green's The Anthropocene Reviewed is newly out, and it's lovely.
Peter, what have you been consuming?
I have been reading the novel Clara and the Sun by Kazuo Ishiguro. The widely awarded and recognized British literary novelist. It is about a robot who is an artificial friend to a little girl in a not quite dystopian future. It is empathetic and humane and decent and honest about the hard choices that we have to make in life. And about the ways that that death comes for and affects us all in strange ways. It's a great, great read. A little bit sad, but fascinating and just deeply decent.
So I watched in a movie theater, which I really recommend. Great fun. Movie theaters, big screens, like sound and stuff.
What do you think, really? Peter? You like those?
I've been to one a couple of times recently.
It's fun.
It's been great.
I really kind of experienced that. Anyways, I went with my 6-year-old to go see Raya and the Last Dragon, which I recommend on two fronts. One is that it's just a pretty good movie. It's basically Moana in Southeast Asia. But we're a coming of age gal with kind of warrior and can do tendencies, tries to fix the problems that plunged the civilization into darkness and all that. And it's very well done. Awkwafina obviously is playing a dragon, which anytime you hear Awkwafina's voice, you just think, let's get an animated movie with Cat Timp's voice. I think that would be a solution to a lot of the world's problems. But anyways, it's also, interestingly, for Nick Gillespie, a meditation on low trust societies and what happens to people when they make decisions with sort of clenched fists where they don't trust the other person and they make a series of cascading mistakes. And I read it entirely as an animated Southeast Asian dragon folkloric take on Nick's warning to all of us that we should have more trust in society. And that's all the trust that we have time for here on the Reason Roundtable podcast. Thank you for listening. Listen to all of our stuff. Catherine will tell you how by email. Send all your emails to roundtable@reason.com. And we will catch you next week on Monday. Thank you. Good night.